We are talking once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No job today. He had some surgery yesterday, so we're hoping he recovers quickly and is back for next week.
Yes.
So that Maria doesn't have to do the whole heavy lifting, especially this week, which was a lot of heavy lifting.
I'm sure Job would have wanted to be here as much as possible to talk about the events this week.
I'm sure
in particular.
Mm-hmm. He's more disappointed than anyone who's listening right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's dive in, starting with the Seattle City Council, which we're back this week.
Yeah, this week the Seattle City Council started meeting again after the holidays, and they passed an ordinance this week on the subpoena power for the OPA and the OIG. Now, back in 2017, when the City Council passed their landmark police accountability legislation, they officially set up the three bodies that oversee the Seattle Police Department, and those three bodies are the Office of Police Accountability, which we'll call the OPA, the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department, which is called the OIG, and the Community Police Commission, which is usually called the CPC. Now, this week, the council passed another law to grant the first two bodies, the OPA and the OIG, the ability to issue subpoenas to victims and witnesses in police use of force cases, which those two bodies investigate. Now, as we've seen with the OPA's investigation of some of the cases surrounding this summer's protests, oftentimes witnesses and victims will refuse to testify before the OPA for fear that their statements could be used against them if the SPD decides to file charges against them for, say, property destruction or rioting or something, or, you know, creating a public disturbance or sometimes even assault on a police officer when, in fact, it was really the victim who was assaulted by the police officer. But this new law now makes it clear that victims and witnesses will be given due process protections so that their statements can't be used against them in future cases if they decide to make a statement to the OPA or the OIG when they're investigating police use of force complaints. Now, of course, the law will also be subject to bargaining with the police union, just like so many other pieces of the police reform legislation that the City Council passed. The city is currently bargaining a new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which expired at the end of December. And whatever new contract they come up with will need to be reviewed by Judge James Robart, who's currently overseeing the police reform process here in the city of Seattle. So the law won't go into effect immediately, but as soon as the judge approves the SPOG contract, and as long as the SPOG contract still allows the OPA and the OIG to issue those subpoenas and to go to a court to seek enforcement of the subpoenas, then that law will go into effect automatically once the contract goes into effect. So that was good news. It's something that the Community Police Commission in particular highly recommended back in 2017 when the police reform law when the City Council initially passed the law that officially created these three bodies, and it's something that they've been pushing for ever since.
Do you have the impression that the subpoena power, you said it was for use of force incidents. Mm-hmm. Any impression if they would use it beyond that?
I mean, there are different types of complaints that are issued with the OPA,
right,
about the police, but in general, for the most part, those complaints surround things like improper use of force.
Okay. And the reason I bring it up today is because last night, I missed it last night, but just saw it this morning, that Adrian Diaz, who is the interim chief SPD posted in the SPD blotter that at least two SPD officers were in DC on the Wednesday, the 6th this week, and that OPA is going
on the
to,
wrong side of the on the wrong side of the barricades. So with the
apparently.
With the marauders, not with the police who are trying to protect the Capitol building and legislators.
Yeah, that's the impression currently. So it seemed like, you know, we've seen the OPA be fairly toothless, if not completely toothless, on so many situations. Him turning it over to the OPA probably doesn't give a lot of people confidence.
The OPA pretty regularly says that, like I said, with some of the investigations that they've done around the protests this summer, they've said many times, you know, we couldn't really come to a conclusion in a lot of these cases because we couldn't interview the victim and we couldn't interview the witnesses. They refused to testify. So the idea is if they have subpoena power, they can go to a court and get a court order that would require the victim and the witnesses to come forward and make a statement with the OPA. And then there's evidence that they can use to uphold a finding of improper use of force and then pursue some kind of sanctions against these officers who routinely violate people's rights. So that's the idea behind the law. And Lisa Herbold, I know, as the chair of the Public Safety Committee on the City Council, she was pretty instrumental in getting this law drafted and passed. And then Mayor Durkan came out. And of course, in the announcement this week, it was Mayor Durkan who presented the bill as a done deal and praised it and tried to take credit for it. But I think it was probably, Council Member Herbold, who was the force behind getting it passed.
But as you just said, it won't really kick in until the next Congress.
Yeah, well, it's still subject to bargaining, and it's not going to kick in immediately. So that's the one caveat there. And you know, that isn't necessarily something that should make us go, oh, it's never gonna take effect, because right now it's not just the mayor's office that's negotiating with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. There are also members of all three of these oversight bodies who are at the bargaining table now. And there's also a city council representative who's in the room who can take notes and inform the city council directly on what's going on with the negotiations. So the negotiations may take a little longer, but they're expected to be, the city's expected to have a stronger position now and to be pushing harder for real reform, to be included in the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. And I'm expecting the subpoena power will also be included.
Yeah.
Let's move to the next one. Speaking of city council members. Yeah, Teresa Mosqueda made an announcement this week that she's going to run for re-election this year for city council position number 8, which is one of the two at-large positions that are up for election this year in November. The other position is at-large position 9, which is currently held by Lorena Gonzalez, who has not yet announced whether she is running for re-election to that seat or if she might want to run for mayor. This announcement by Mosqueda means that she has decided not to run for mayor. Mayor Durkan had announced last month that she's not running for re-election. So, and many folks have been speculating that either Mosqueda or Gonzalez would jump into the mayor's race, but so far neither one has. And this week, Mosqueda confirmed that she is definitely not going to do that. Now, this year, Mosqueda has served as city council budget chair during a really, really tough year. It's been a very difficult year. She had to shepherd through a major revision to the 2020 city budget. She oversaw a COVID-19 relief bill. She also crafted sponsored and oversaw the passage of the new Jumpstart payroll tax on businesses with employees who make over $150,000 a year. And she also helped craft a very difficult new budget for 2021, all while trying to trim back spending on the Seattle police. and increase funding for communities of color and for the participatory budgeting process. And then she's also been working with the other city council members to try to find more money for things like homelessness services, for affordable housing, for food programs, for public health programs, and for a very key piece of transportation infrastructure that's starting to fail, which is the West Seattle Bridge. And she's had to do all of that with a mayor who has not been helpful at all and actually stepped in and vetoed some of that legislation, including the COVID-19 relief bill and the revised 2020 budget. So it's been a difficult year, and she's been, she's done a really, really good job and been very graceful in the way that she's done her work. And I kind of expected her to maybe want to run for mayor so that she wouldn't have to go through a year like this again. But apparently, it seems that, she thrives on this, and Mosqueda is, maybe thinking that 2021 will be a little bit easier and that the worst is over, which is, I think, kind of hopeful for the rest of us. So it's nice to see her want to run for re-election.
Mm-hmm. And she did all that while raising a brand new kid.
Yes, it's true. She has a very young child at home. Both she and Lorena Gonzalez was pregnant early last year and delivered a new baby. So, yeah, it's very interesting to see these two council members be so productive and so on top of things while also being new mothers. That can be really hard. And it's very encouraging, I think, to see Councilmember Mosqueda decide that she wants to stay in her position. Now, also this week, we got news that a different local politician was resigning from their position. Eden Mack posted on Facebook and released a letter saying that she is resigning from the Seattle School Board. She's Eden Mack is the representative for School Board District 4, which covers Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. Mack was formerly the legislative chair for the Seattle Council Parent, Teacher, and Student Association, where she worked primarily on school funding issues with the state legislature and local school districts. In her resignation letter, and you know, I think voters really supported Mack because they thought, okay, here's somebody who knows the funding issues inside and out, and the Seattle School District has had budget deficits and funding scandals and problems with trying to get the budget to balance. So let's elect someone who has a good financial background who can come in and help clean things up. In her resignation letter, Mack really cites the chronic long-term problems with the underfunding of Seattle schools, which has negatively impacted class size, curriculum, facilities maintenance, and special education students. And then she says that when Seattle is going to have to bring students back to school, probably later in 2021, there's just not enough money to do that safely and to do that effectively. Mack also makes it clear in her letter that hiring a new superintendent is not going to fix the problem. And she cites the revolving door of superintendent, school board members, and district staff as one of the biggest hurdles in fixing the problem. And the solution that she calls for, I think, is very important. And that really, really struck me. She, right off the bat, asks the state superintendent's office to step in and do a full audit of the Seattle School District from its finances all the way down to its staffing. And she calls for a change in how the state legislature funds schools based on that audit. In addition, she suggests that school board positions for the largest district in the state should be paid full-time positions with adequate training and support staff instead of the all-volunteer part-time jobs that they are now. And in fact, when you look at the number of hours that school board members work, they're really not part-time jobs. They're actually all-volunteer full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. Now, asking the state superintendent's office to step in might seem extreme, but Seattle schools have been dealing with, and she's absolutely right. Seattle schools have been dealing with scandals and funding problems for years, and we have had high turnover, particularly in the top management, the superintendent and other top management at Seattle schools for over a decade. Requesting that school board positions be paid is also not a crazy request. Some other major metropolitan areas have paid school board members already. They already have paid school board members, and that includes the Los Angeles Unified School District, the Miami-Dade County Public Schools in Florida, San Diego schools, and Fairfax County in Virginia. But some large city school districts like Seattle, like the New York City Department of Education and the Chicago Public Schools still don't have paid school board members. And it's been a topic of discussion among education specialists and educational groups, whether or not paid school board members would make sense, particularly in large urban areas where it's a thankless job, essentially. It's becoming much more than just that part-time volunteer position that requires, in the Seattle School District, it requires more than 30 hours per week just of meetings, meeting prep, dealing with community members, much less answering email and doing the research that you need in order to make good policy decisions. You know, one former school board member had commented that just keeping on top of the email is difficult and is a full-time job. And school board members don't have any administrative assistants or office staff to help them with that kind of thing, like legislators or even port commissioners have. In 2013, State Representative Reuven Carlisle had proposed a bill to pay school board members in Washington State up to $42,000 per year. That would have been the same pay that a state legislator made at that time. And that pay could be on a sliding scale based on the size of the school district and the number of hours involved. Since then, that bill didn't pass. And since then, not much has been done to try to revisit that topic in the state legislature. But it may be high time that we do that. Here in Seattle, we pay our port commissioners, who are supposed to oversee the port and come up with policies for the Seattle port. So the question is, why aren't we paying our school board members to oversee the school district and come up with educational policy for our Seattle schools? It's really, I think, a matter of priorities. And Washington State still has a long ways to go before we fully fund education the way we should be doing. So that was kind of interesting. Eden Mack is using her resignation as a way to bring up these very important issues to say, look, McCleary's not done, you know. The legislature should be looking at this again. And, yeah. and she also called for the state superintendent's office to step in.
Well, speaking of, Olympia.
Yes. Speaking of Olympia, you know, the state legislature's not in session yet. It will, formally begin its session on Monday, but there were people in Olympia, this week on Wednesday. The chaos in Washington, D.C. spilled over to our state's capital here in Olympia. A group of around 300 people, many of them armed, stood on the steps of the empty Capitol building and demanded that the state legislature, which of course was not in session yet, overturn the will of Washington voters and declare Donald Trump the winner of the presidential race in Washington state. Well, the thing is, Joe Biden took 750,000 more votes here in Washington state than Donald Trump did. So disenfranchising 785,000 people, essentially throwing their votes in the garbage, is what these 300 right-wing protesters armed with pistols and sticks were asking. Now, remember, we have a Republican Secretary of State here in Washington, Kim Wyman, who's been in charge of our elections for a number of years, and she was just reelected to that position. She has come out against Donald Trump's and his supporters' calls for overturning the results of the election, saying that she believes that no fraud has been committed anywhere in the United States, most particularly not here in Washington State. Now, when you look at this, the absurdity of 300 protesters at an empty Capitol building in Washington state asking for one of the most liberal states in the nation to completely throw out the election process, to overturn a vote that was obviously always going to be for Biden and give it to Donald Trump, you have to just kind of snicker. You know, it's sort of funny if these groups weren't so scary and violent in addition to just being so, so stupid, which takes us to our national news, right? And the actual chaos in D.C., which was really not funny. And I have several things I want to say about that. First off, Trump obviously couldn't get the U.S. military. He couldn't get Congress, couldn't get the courts or Republican state legislatures or even his own White House staff to stage a coup. So his last-ditch effort was to speak at a right-wing rally on Wednesday and sic a group of violent white supremacists and QAnon conspiracy supporters on Congress. Unfortunately, it didn't work, although 5 people died in the process, including 1 Washington, D.C. police officer and 4 protesters, one of whom was shot by a D.C. police officer. Now, apparently, the organizing for this event, so-called event, including exhortations of violence and overthrow of the U.S. government, happened in broad daylight on public social media accounts. But it was apparently not noticed by the FBI, Homeland Security, or the Washington, D.C. police. And D.C. police were so unprepared for the protest that they were not wearing riot gear or using the less lethal weapons that they routinely trot out against Black Lives Matter protesters. Weapons like tear gas, pepper spray, flashbang grenades, blast balls, rubber bullets, foam-tipped rounds, dye, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and let's remember too, Black Lives Matter protesters don't usually run up to the Capitol building, you know, armed with guns and metal pipes, bust windows, break furniture, you know, threaten to kidnap or kill people. No, Black Lives Matter protesters typically block traffic and spray paint things. And occasionally they set off fireworks. That's about the sum of the crimes that BLM and Antifa protesters engage in, right? But the folks at the Capitol were not doing those things at all, no. Although, you know, I do have to say, too, when the attempted coup failed and was widely condemned in the media, the far right then tried to say that Antifa folks had dressed up as Trump supporters and staged the violence. And that was so ridiculous because, you know, Antifa folks are smart enough to wear masks. And in fact, they've been wearing masks since long before the pandemic, right? But none of these marauders in the state capitol were wearing masks, so their faces are easily recognizable, and they're now being widely exposed and identified through the videos and photos that they've posted on their social media accounts. And of course they're exactly who we think they are. They're white racists, QAnon dupes, neo-Nazis, gun rights fanatics, and even 1 Republican lawmaker from West Virginia who was just elected in November, Derek Evans, posted a video on his social media account of himself storming the Capitol building to protest a corrupt election that he won in his state. So that's the kind of person who was at the Capitol. And, of course, we're now finding out a couple of Seattle police officers were there and perhaps more members of the SPD in the crowd that was marauding on Wednesday. Now, while the rioters delayed the electoral vote certification for a few hours, once the D.C. police stopped posing with the rioters for selfies and the National Guard moved in to eject looters from the building, Congress resumed and certified Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. So the fallout from all of this, more than 50 criminal cases are being opened against some of the extremists who participated in the riots on Wednesday. And like I said, they're easy to identify by the many photos and videos that they've posted to their social media accounts. The rioters were armed with guns, metal pipes, bear spray, tear gas, and other weapons. One person was carrying a semi-automatic rifle and 11 Molotov cocktails when he was arrested by D.C. police. Pipe bombs were found at both the Democratic National Committee headquarters and the Republican National Committee headquarters. Police found gasoline bombs inside a car parked on the Capitol grounds. Most disturbingly, some of the rioters who entered the Capitol building had zip ties and handguns on them as if they were prepared to take hostages. In spite of all this, D.C. police only arrested 14 people on Wednesday. The D.C. police chief, thankfully, resigned afterwards, which, of course, is leaving it up to the Homeland Security and the FBI to pursue and make further arrests. Now, all of the Democrats in Congress have called for an impeachment vote against Donald Trump to prevent him from ever being able to run for president again. And House leadership are currently preparing articles of impeachment that they hope to vote on early next week. Many have called for Vice President Mike Pence and the remaining members of the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Donald Trump from office immediately, although so far only Steven Mnuchin has even considered doing that. It's also possible that Trump may face criminal charges for his actions on Wednesday once he leaves office 11 days from now, if not sooner. At any rate, at least now we know what it takes to get permanently banned from Facebook, right?
And on Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter. Although Twitter delayed for a couple of days. They didn't ban him until Friday, permanently remove his account. Trump tried to get around the ban by using the @POTUS, which is the official President of the United States account. And then when that was removed, Twitter had to remove the official President of the United States account to prevent Trump from tweeting violent lies, right? Then Trump tried using the @TeamTrump account, which is his campaign's Twitter account. But then Twitter also removed that account. And they have said that they will prevent him from setting up any new accounts on Twitter. Meanwhile, people who track right-wing militia groups have told the media that there's further organizing on social media for more violent acts in Washington, D.C. There's a million militia march being planned for January 20th, which is Inauguration Day. And on January 17th, there's been a call for armed marches on both state capitals and in Washington, D.C., and also calls for violent protests on the day before the inauguration. So the organizing to try to overthrow the U.S. government, to overthrow a democratically elected government in order to replace the legally elected candidate with Donald Trump, the dictator Donald Trump, continues. And it's quite interesting to follow. It's also quite interesting to note, too, that everyone thought something like this was going to happen, except for the FBI, Homeland Security, and Washington D.C. police. And it's a real scandal that while the U.S. military stood down and refused requests from Donald Trump to step in, that the FBI and Homeland Security did absolutely nothing on Wednesday.
Yeah, it will be interesting as time goes on to see what evidence comes up about, for instance, the FBI and security groups in D.C., whether they thought it wasn't really a threat or if they, clearly they made a decision to stand down and not use their forces. So
not be prepared.
Yeah, to find what the reasoning on that was, their thinking behind that will be illuminating when that comes forward. The another part of the fallout is the expected amping up of anti-domestic terrorism infrastructure and laws that are going to be pushed forward from all this and how those will impact everyone.
Well, how those will be used.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because traditionally, those have been used.
Exactly. What we find is that traditionally, it's acts of right-wing terror that bring those laws, those strengthening of laws about. But then in the end, those laws are used against left-wing and often peaceful protesters and activist groups. So it'll be interesting to see if that occurs again this time.
And used against, people of color,
often.
A lot.
Yes.
So people need to be thinking through all the potential outcomes of this and chewing on that now. I know all of this has been a long time coming. It's a continuation of a curve that shouldn't be surprising to anyone and that a lot of people have been trying to bring attention to for the better part of my life.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit too about news that kind of got buried by all this week. One of those pieces of news was early in the week. It was reported that Donald Trump had made a possibly treasonous phone call to the Secretary of State of Georgia to try to get the election overturned in Georgia. He had, Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, had told the media that, the Washington Post had obtained the actual recording of an hour-long phone call wherein Donald Trump, exhorted the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger of Georgia, to, find the fraud and find the votes that would allow him to win the state. And it was very clear that Trump was crossing some very strong and very firm legal lines in that phone call. But what wasn't, reported, earlier this week and that, has been kind of buried by all the other news around the chaos on Wednesday is that that was not the only call that Donald Trump made to officials in Georgia. Apparently, before he reached Raffensperger, he made 18 calls to try to get a hold of Raffensperger. And those 18 calls were routed to staff, to administrative staff in the Georgia Secretary of State's office, who hung up on him because they thought it was a crank call. 18 times. Right. Now, most of us, if we call an agency or someone's office and we get hung up on a couple of times, we think, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong and I need to try something different. Right. Mm-hmm. But if you have Alzheimer's or if you have dementia, you don't remember that you made 17 other calls before you make the 18th call. Right. Before you pick up your cell phone to rant for the 18th time to the same people, you know? I think really, you know, there's not enough examination of what's going on in the White House and what these White House aides are enabling when they protect Donald Trump. And they say, oh, he didn't mean that. What he meant was. I mean, we've heard all this before. I remember when Ronald Reagan was in office and his aides were routinely reinterpreting things that he had said, saying, oh, he didn't really mean that. What he meant was this. And then we learned years later that he actually had dementia when he was president. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very clear sign that Trump has got some health issues going on and that Pence should have long ago invoke the 25th Amendment to remove him from office. Now, in addition to those 18 calls to try to get hold of Brad Raffensperger, and eventually he did get a hold of him, but it was Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, who organized the call, that hour-long phone call. There were two other calls earlier, one that Trump made in early December to Georgia Governor Brian Kemp to try to get him to bully Raffensperger to overturn the results of the election. And there was another call just before Christmas to Brad Raffensperger's office where Trump actually got a hold of the lead investigator who was conducting an audit of Georgia ballots to in Cobb County to try to find out if the right-wing charges that there were a lot of mail-in ballots that had been counted where the signatures didn't match the signatures on file. There was an investigator who was conducting an audit in Cobb County, and Trump actually got a hold of him and was trying to get that person, him or her, was trying to get that person to throw out a number of ballots in Cobb County. In addition to Trump's calls to Brian Kemp and to the lead investigator in that audit, Senator Lindsey Graham also called Raffensperger's office in December to talk about whether the ballots from the mail-in ballots from entire counties could be just thrown in the trash if they had a high enough rate of signature mismatches. So it appears Senator Lindsey Graham was also involved in trying to manipulate the election in Georgia. And then in late December, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows actually traveled to Georgia to follow up in person on the ballot signature investigation. And fortunately, Raffensperger wouldn't let him actually go into the room where the audit was occurring, although Mark Meadows could peek into the room from outside through a window. He was not allowed to go in and actually bully the people who were doing the work of trying to audit the signatures. And then, of course, on December 29th, Georgia election officials announced the results of that audit in Cobb County. They had examined 15,000 signatures total and found only two that mismatched the signatures that were on file. So there was not widespread fraud in Cobb County in Georgia. There was no widespread fraud found. There were just two signature mismatches. And of course, as we know, that signature mismatches can be quite common. If you register to vote when you're 18, your signature can look very, very different from what it is when, say, you're 60 or 62, particularly if you have arthritis or if you have something like Parkinson's or a tremor disorder that can change. Widely
my signature changes. Varies from day to day.
Yeah. Now, it's recommended that if you registered a long, long time ago, you might want to, when you get, particularly when you renew your driver's license, you may want to update your signature with your state elections department so that they do have a current signature for you on file so that your ballot is not disqualified for that reason. So we do know that signature mismatches don't necessarily mean that the wrong person voted. Right. It can just mean that your signature has changed.
Right, but 2 out of 15,000 is phenomenally good.
Is a phenomenally low rate. Yeah. Of course Trump was angered by that outcome. So that's what that outcome was announced on December 29th, and that's what one of the big things that he was fuming about in his hour-long call on January 2nd to Brad Raffensperger was, you know, how could you not find fraud? How could you look at 15,000 signatures, match them, and not find more mismatches? Couldn't you go back and try again and, you know, look for fraud? You know, or get people in the room who are more willing to say, look, these two signatures, which look identical, are actually not the same. So essentially that's what he was urging.
But that didn't work out for him.
No, that didn't work out for him. And so then there was also more news coming out of Georgia on Tuesday. The other big news this week is that both U.S. Senate runoff elections in Georgia were won by Democrats. The Reverend Raphael Warnock beat Kelly Loeffler by about 85,000 votes, which is a good, healthy margin. It was close, but not so close that it was a squeaker. And John Ossoff's margin was narrower, but also he beat David Perdue by, a pretty decisive 47,000 votes. So, again, close, but not a squeaker. Democrats took advantage of early voting to turn out Democratic voters in high numbers. Also, Warnock and Ossoff raised enormous amounts of money between October 15th and December 16th. John Ossoff raised $106.7 million, and that's the most money that any senatorial candidate has raised in one quarter in U.S. history. And it's higher by a magnitude of twofold, so pretty much doubled what any one senatorial candidate has ever raised in one quarter. Warnock raised well over $103 million in that time period, so he also brought in record amounts of money. By comparison, Republican David Perdue raised $68 million, and Republican Kelly Loeffler raised $64 million. So both Warnock and Ossoff outraised Perdue and Loeffler. And I think most importantly, you need to look at the breakdown, too. Nearly half of all the donations to the two Democratic candidates, Ossoff and Warnock, were small donations of under $200. For the two Republicans, only 30% of their donations were small donations under $200. So think about that. At a time when we have COVID-19 and a lot of people are out of work or they're not able to work the number of hours that they usually could, maybe they're having some real financial insecurity, there were still enough people around the United States who could dig into their bank accounts and find $20 or $50 or, you know, some small amount that they could send to the Georgia senatorial campaigns, because they so want to overturn Republican control of the Senate, right?
There was also a ton of volunteers from around the country that went to Georgia to work there on those campaigns.
To help turn out Democrats.
Yeah,
to
I know people from this state that did that.
Yeah, and it really made a difference. So even in times of pandemic, people can make the decision to act to make political progress where they can.
As we saw in the streets of Seattle earlier this year.
Oh yeah. So what this means for Congress now is that there's an even 50-50 split in the Senate. And that means that Vice President Kamala Harris is going to be very busy in the next couple of years, spending a lot of time breaking tie votes in the Senate to get the Democrats' bills passed, and maybe even just very basic bills, like bills to fund the federal government, which the Republicans have a tendency to hold up. Because, you know, they're all about obstruction and about destroying and being a wrecking ball. I think Donald Trump, you could call the ultimate wrecking ball, sort of the end point of the Republican philosophy that not just small government is better, but no government is better. And so we'll see now that Democrats have control of the House and have control of the Senate. What kind of legislation we can get passed in terms of expanding access to healthcare and dealing with, I think, two of the most important issues nationwide. One is dealing with global warming, and the other is dealing with massive income inequality in the United States. One of those is going to mean making major changes in how we operate in our economy in terms of how transportation and utilities function. That's the first one of those two issues, dealing with global warming, and maybe making some major infrastructure investments to shift from an economy that runs on oil and gas to an economy that runs on renewable energy. And the other is instituting major tax reform policies to try to deal with income inequality. The best way that the federal government can deal with income inequality is to impose higher taxes on the rich and on businesses, to essentially reverse tax cuts that were passed under George W. Bush and under Donald Trump. and we'll see how far the Democrats can go with that. There are a lot of what we call conservative Democrats who are actually sort of socially liberal but economically conservative who may not go for a lot of those tax policies. So it'll be interesting to see if Joe Biden, who I've always considered one of those conservative Democrats, if Joe Biden will actually spearhead that movement, or if it's going to have to come from the progressives in the party, as it usually does, and then end up not really going anywhere, which is why the Republicans can get together and pass tax cuts, but the Democrats seldom get together and pass really meaningful tax increases. They do increase taxes from time to time, but it doesn't tend to make up for the damage done by the Republicans. We'll see if that can change in the coming legislative sessions in D.C.
All right.
Okay.
Also this week, speaking of Biden.
Yeah, speaking of Biden and his incoming administration, Biden announced almost his final cabinet picks. He still has one more position open, and that's CIA director. And at this point, I'm thinking he's probably going to keep Gina Haspel, unfortunately. And I think he's probably holding off actually saying that because he doesn't want Trump to fire her out of spite, which is something that Donald Trump would do. I hate to say that, but I think that's a possibility. But let's talk about his other picks this week. For Attorney General, which is one that everybody's been waiting for a while, he decided on Merrick Garland. Garland was originally named by Obama as his pick to fill the Supreme Court seat that was left vacant when Antonin Scalia died. But the Republican majority in the Senate at that time refused to even hold a hearing on Garland's nomination, to even meet with Garland to talk about him. Instead, they spent a whole year keeping that seat vacant so that in the hopes that Donald Trump would get elected so that he could fill the seat, which is actually what happened. Garland has worked in corporate law. That was his first job. And he then went on to work as an assistant U.S. attorney at the Department of Justice, where he prosecuted domestic terrorism cases, including the Oklahoma City bombing, the Unabomber case, and the bombings at the Atlanta Olympics. He's served since 1997 as a U.S. appeals court judge for the D.C. Circuit. He's considered a moderate who often sides with prosecutors and the police. So he's not a great pick when it comes to advocates for police reform. And I have to say I'm kind of disappointed that Biden didn't pick one of the other candidates he was considering. Garland hasn't run a large agency before, so he's also not a great pick administratively, like Sally Yates, who would have been great on police reform, and she served as interim attorney general. So she has the experience of running a large organization. I think she would have been a great choice. Garland has also mostly been serving as a judge. So has a lot more recent experience on the bench than actually working before the bench, as you would expect with the lead prosecutor for the United States government. So he's not the best pick if you want a good prosecutor either. So I think what we're seeing here is we're seeing Joe Biden still in that old school tough on crime Democrat mode that progressives have been criticizing him for. He really hasn't changed a whole lot on that, even though he talks a good game about prison reform and police reform, et cetera. He didn't pick a police reformer for his attorney general. He picked someone who has a lot of experience on an appeals court and who tends to side with police and prosecutors, but who doesn't have a whole lot of experience running a large organization, but is obviously also someone he really likes and is going to enjoy working with. That, I think, is something that Biden is also known for, picking his friends and buddies to work with him. So that was quite disappointing this week, I think. Of course, Garland's going to be better than Jeff Sessions was. This is going to be a whole lot better than than Bates. So we'll just see how it all turns out.
Oh, we will.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have to say I was hoping that the reason Biden was delaying until January was to see the outcome of the Georgia elections and then he would pick Sally Yates or someone of her caliber who would have a tough time making it through a Republican controlled Senate, but not if Democrats had control. But that wasn't the reason he was delaying. I think he was probably just delaying to get the okay from Garland that he wanted to actually do that job. Okay. Now, for Secretary of Commerce, Biden picked Gina Raimondo. Raimondo has been the governor of Rhode Island since 2015, and she's the first woman to hold that job. Before that, she served as the general treasurer of Rhode Island from 2011 to 2015. She has also served as the chair and vice chair of the Democratic Governors Association. She has a BA in economics from Harvard. She was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where she graduated with a PhD in sociology. She worked in venture capital in the early aughts and founded the first venture capital firm in Rhode Island, Point Judith Capital, which she still holds an executive position at that company, even though she's also the governor of Rhode Island. Now, during her time as governor, she pushed lawmakers to pass legislation granting tax credits and tax incentives to companies to move to Rhode Island. And she has used her time as governor to try to make the state more, quote-unquote, business-friendly. Now, during the recent presidential campaign, to kind of show you who Raimondo is and what her values are, during the recent presidential campaign, Raimondo came out in support of billionaire Mike Bloomberg's candidacy, and she became the co-chair of his campaign. Now, when Bloomberg dropped out of the race and immediately endorsed Biden, Raimondo very quickly did the same, and it's very clear that she would be in the running for a cabinet post if Biden was elected. So, that's who Raimondo is. Now, as Secretary of Commerce, she's going to be overseeing an agency that includes the Economic Development Administration, the Minority Business Development Agency, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the International Trade Administration, Export Enforcement, and the Economic and Statistics Administration, which includes the Census Bureau in it, among other agencies, including a few smaller agencies like the NOAA is also in the Commerce Department, and there are other smaller agencies as well. And presidents typically appoint a pro-business person to run the Department of Commerce. Raimondo definitely comes from the pro, is as pro-business as you can get, but she's also her experience is not with small businesses. It's not expanding the access to business resources to people of color necessarily and poor people. It's been all from sort of a top down look. She's very much a venture capitalist and working with millionaires and billionaires. So that's who Raimondo is. Now, for Secretary of Labor, Biden picked Marty Walsh. Walsh is the mayor of Boston, and he's been the mayor of Boston since 2014. And he was formerly a representative in the Massachusetts House of Representatives from 1997 to 2014, a good long tenure there. He has also served as the president of his labor's union Local 223 and as the head of the Boston Building Trades Council before he was mayor of Boston. Walsh is not well known for his labor work nationally, although he is well known locally in Boston and Massachusetts for running the Boston Building Trades Council. But he's also a very close personal friend of Joe Biden. Again, Biden chose a friend over other more diverse candidates with deeper labor backgrounds. Some of the big AFL-CIO labor unions backed Walsh, including the American Federation of Teachers and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. But the United Farm Workers backed California State Labor Secretary Julie Sue, who would have been a good pick. And several unions backed Michigan Representative Andy Levine of Detroit, not sure exactly how you pronounce his name, the United Auto Workers, the Utility Workers of America, and the Communication Workers of America, and I think also a major nurses union backed Andy Levin. Levin is also known for his labor organizing skills, and he would have been a very good pick too. But when confronted with dissension in the rank and file, Biden naturally picked the guy he knows and likes among the different candidates, instead of, I think, really considering who would have been the best pick for the job. Walsh is going to have a big job as heading up the Department of Labor. Unemployment under COVID-19 has been high, and the Trump administration has gutted or failed to enforce worker safety laws, equal employment laws, and wage and hour protections. And then there's the long-standing issue of the national minimum wage, which hasn't been increased since 2009, when it was set at $7.25 an hour, which is now preposterously low. So big job coming up for him. And then the final pick I want to talk about this week is Biden's pick for heading up the Small Business Administration, Isabel Guzman. She was currently the director of California's Office of the Small Business Advocate. She served as the deputy chief of staff to the former Small Business Administrator in the Obama administration. So she has prior experience working at the Small Business Administration and helping to run the agency. Prior to working in the Obama administration, she worked for Pro-America Bank, serving small and mid-sized businesses that needed loans and startup capital. Now, the Small Business Administration provides free counseling to people who want to start businesses. It helps small businesses to get loans and find startup capital. It helps businesses with disaster relief, and it provides assistance to businesses that want to contract with the federal government. So she's actually a pretty good pick for that job. It appears that Biden has probably worked with her in the past, and she was also working at the SBA under the Obama administration. So again, somebody Biden knows, but a person who is highly qualified to fill that job. So that rounds out the major cabinet picks that Biden made this week.
Okay.
Yeah. Some disappointments and some who are probably okay. Uh-huh. At least one that's probably okay.
Can you give us a quick COVID update?
COVID update, yeah. Total COVID-19 cases in the U.S. reached 21.6 million this week, and total deaths exceeded 365,000. The new record this week is that new daily cases are now above the 300,000 mark. That's a new high. And if you want to put that number into context, that's equal to the combined population of Bellevue, Kirkland, and Redmond, Washington, who are getting infected with COVID-19 every day in the United States. Now, the United States ranks number one in the world for number of confirmed cases at 21.6 million, more than double the next highest nation, which is India, which has had a total of 10.5 million confirmed cases. Most other highly populated nations have around 1 to 3 million cases, and that includes Russia, Britain, France, Italy, Spain, and Germany. Yes, that is correct. They each have had about one-tenth the number of cases that we've had here in the United States. So that should put into perspective the failed policies of the Trump administration in not doing much of anything to try to control COVID-19. So far, 22 million doses of vaccine have been distributed, and 6.7 million people have received their first doses, according to the CDC. In total, that's about 2% of the U.S. population. At that rate, it could take many, many years, if not a whole decade, to vaccinate the entire U.S. population. So something has to change, and it has to change quickly. hopefully come January 20th, when we get a new administration in place, there will be a speed up in the number of people who are vaccinated every day, because that desperately needs to happen.
Okay. Well, with that, we are out of time.
Yeah.
I know, that's a shocker.
We'll be back next week.
We will.
And hopefully Bob will be with us too.
Fingers crossed.